I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome everybody to this Royal Automobile Club talk show. Now, this is a special talk show for two reasons. We have a fantastic guest today, Hans Stuck. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Hello, everybody.
The second reason is that it's London Motor Week this week. It's the end of October. London Motor Week involves a number of events at the Royal Automobile Club and the London to Brighton run. And one of the events at the Royal Automobile Club was a dinner last night, in your honour. How was the dinner last night?
Just one word, it was fabulous, thank you. It was an honor for me to be there with all these really very nice and interesting guests. And beside that, dinner was my homemade style. It was Austrian Wiener Schnitzel and Kaiserschmarrn. Compliment to the kitchen, they performed very well, you know. And the talk section was great, so altogether it was a very, very nice evening.
Good stuff. Well, today we'd like to talk to you about a racing career that spanned 43 years. And the career spanned sports cars, Le Mans racing, touring cars, Formula One, Formula Two, in arguably the most exciting era in history, the 60s, 70s and 80s. So, but I'd like to go back to when you were 9 years old, I think. And I'm sure you told this story last night at the dinner, but I'd love to know your feelings as a nine-year-old boy about to drive your very first laps of the Nürburgring. Please tell me about this experience.
Yes, I mean, thinking back now, being 9 years and driving at the world's most famous racetrack is now even more important than it was in these days for me, you know. It was in the little BMW 700, my dad's company car, and I knew how to drive a car because he taught me on the premises when I was six or seven. And he was an instructor at these legendary Nürburgring driving schools, the section around the carousel. He let me drive the car there back and forth, and he said, okay, I'm a little boy, now we do a lap together. I sit on the passenger seat, I got two cushions under my butt, you know, and we drove around. Daddy gave advice, and after lap five, he said, no, you go on your own. I get seasick, you drive on your own, you know. But can you imagine being 9 years old, driving on the Nürburgring, on the world's most demanding racetrack in the BMW 700? And it went fine, no crash, nothing, you know. Yeah. And this obviously when this virus was then set, yeah, and stayed up to today, that's important.
I have to ask, if it was your father's company car, did your father's company know?
I would say no, definitely not, you know. Definitely not, but I mean, they knew, then they got to know pretty soon afterwards, you know, but at this day, definitely not.
That's an interesting word you used there, a virus, and that's the virus for speed or for driving? What was that?
It was a fuel virus. Everything, yeah, where you put fuel in, it's still nowadays, you know. At home, I live in a skiing area in Kitzbühel, I have a snowmobile, 140 horsepower. I have a quad bike, you know. And if I do lots of sport, but I need sport with sound, with engines, you know, this is important,
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, so it was only 10 or so years later that you made your race debut. But am I right in saying that you couldn't actually get a racing license in Germany until you had your road driving license?
And you had to be 18.
And you had to be 18, okay. So you passed your driving test, you raced at the Nürburgring, and then 1 year later, as a 19-year-old, you won. You won the 24 hours of the Nürburgring. Tell me about that race in particular and your feelings as you were driving 24 hours.
Yes, let's go back to the first race, to the start.
Yes. You know?
It was one of these driving schools. Another instructor was legendary Hans-Peter Köppchen, a BMW tuner. And he approached my dad and said, Hans, you know, I watch your son driving here. I want him to race on the coming weekend.
Yes.
Would you agree? And then it was a very difficult decision for my dad. Before, everything was fun and just enjoying. But then he knew when he gives me permission to do this race, this would be a start of a big thing. Because he, yes, you know, he had in his long career many heavy accidents. He had ups and downs, what is normal. And he knew if I say yes now, is it good or not? Yeah. But there was no chance. He had to say yes, you know, definitely. I put so much pressure on him, you know.
Yeah.
Then I did this first race, which is okay. And then I came the first 24 hours at Nürburgring,
yeah,
which was really cool. And in the BMW 2002 TI with my, yes, partner, Clemens Schickendanz. And it all, I mean, those were the days we had no physios, we had no motorhomes, we had no drinks and special food. We were sitting there eating French fries and drinking Coke, you know. Mm. But it was great. I mean, yeah, the race car came on the road to the racetrack.
They drove there on the road.
Yeah, they, yeah, took the bumpers, yeah, off, take the seats out, and then we were going. This was the basic of motorsport, you know.
And there were two of you, not four of you, like nowadays.
No, two. No, yeah, my partner was Clemens Schickendanz, you know. He was a nice guy driving. We were two, you know. And we clicked together and we did it, you know. And we had all kinds of weather issues and stuff like this, but the engine was fine, the car was staying together, and we won the race.
And it was driven home on the road?
Yes, definitely.
Wonderful. Was there any question as a young teenager that you wanted to do anything else? Was you were born in the sort of the space race era when kids were thinking about, I want to be an astronaut, I want to do this, I want to fly jet planes. But for you, was it always the virus for petrol?
There was about a half a year doubt, and you will be laughing, I want to become a priest. Yes. But thanks to God, it's not the case, because can you imagine me being a priest would be terrible for a Catholic church, you know?
I would go to your church if you were.
Okay.
Your sermons would be wonderful.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, this was about a half an hour phase where I had this, you know, but it changed pretty quickly because, as I told yesterday, my father was building the AFM race car on our premises, and I, as a kid, was watching the mechanics. They assembled the car, put on the truck and stuff like this. So it was logic I wanted this. And then from this moment on, I decided I want to become a race car driver. I also followed my dad to his last races in the 60s, you know, yes, and admired him, what he did, the performance he put on the table, and seeing what motorsport means, you know, to fight with something you have to put your will and wish onto the car, you know, was really, for me, was fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So this period, did you race at other circuits around Germany at this time, or was it solely at the Nürburgring where you were sort of finding your skill and your passion?
No, it was also Hockenheim, of course. Yes. And in these days, to become an international license, you had to have five results in the top three.
Okay.
And my dad had a great idea. You know what? After this first race, Nürburgring, it was a 300-kilometer race. I did four hill climb races. Because hill climb is not much to do, because you drive up twice on the weekend, and was valuable positions and points for my international license. So I did four hill climb racing. I think I won three of them,
yeah,
and that was also good practice, because hill climb is a one of a chance, you know, on, yes, a circuit race you do 20, 30, 40 laps, but on a hill climb you only have two chances, and the time you lose on the run you can't make up. So it was a good educational phase for me.
Sure.
You say it's not much to do at a hill climb, but most European hill climbs, I mean, are about 10, 12, 14 kilometres long. They're not like British hill climbs that last 20 seconds.
That's right, like Chesley was. Yeah. No, the one was a pretty long one in Freiburg. Scharensland was about a 5 minute, but the other one were short ones, and the time we had around was pretty good.
Were you driving just touring cars?
Yeah, touring cars. Always BMW in the beginning, yeah.
So let's move into the 70s. Now, you developed a relationship with Jochen Nierpach. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about how important he was in the 70s to your career.
Yeah, I did the first years with BMW, with Köppchen, Alpina, and then Jochen Nierpach, who was in these days race director of Ford Motorsport in Cologne. He approached me and said, look, I've watched you, I've seen you. He actually talked to my dad. And I think you're an interesting kid. I see you have a lot of talent. Would you be willing to race for us in 72 in the German championship?
Mm-hmm.
My dad said, yes, thank you, good idea, you know, signed a good contract. So I went up to Cologne and won this Deutsche Rennsportmeisterschaft in 72. Also won then the race in Spa with Jochen Maas, 24-hour race. And then, funny enough, Jochen Nierpach moved from Ford to BMW.
Yes.
Because BMW changed all their racing things and everything, and they hired Jochen Nierpach, who was definitely in these days one of the best as a race director. And then Jochen Nierpach said, Hans, you know, you are Bavarian, you have to be, you have to drive for BMW. So come with me, you know, which was a good chance. Yes. And so I came back to BMW with Jochen. And Jochen then was really taking good care of my career. He brought me into Formula 2 because of BMW did this Formula 2 engine. Then I came via Formula 2 into Formula 1. And then went with BMW to the States and this and that. So it was definitely the right step. Also, what you need in life is luck. if NEPA shouldn't have moved back to BMW, we know where I would have ended up, you know. So you see, yeah, that's life.
Sure thing. And I think it was interesting as well at that time, because very quickly you were racing in America with Ronnie Peterson as well, and that must have been an incredible experience to go over to the other side of the Atlantic and try those circuits. Tell me about your experience in the States.
Yeah, when I left 75, and I was 24 years old, you know, I had to go, like, the first break was like 3 months in a row, you know, leaving home for a long time the first time. So I took toothpaste with me, hair shampoo, not knowing me, stupid guy. It's all over there in the States, 100,000 times, you know. I also took my girlfriend, which was good, you know. She was able to come with me. And then the first trip was to Chicago. We picked up one of these fantastic GMC motorhomes. Oh, yeah. Because Jochen said, when you take a girlfriend, we pay, but you have to take care of the motorhome, you know. So we went into a motorhome and we traveled around in the States for the next 3 months, which was cool for 24-year-old, you know, to get this experience in the States, to get to know the States, because, you know, when you're a race car driver, you go to different tracks all over the country. It's the best experience you can do. And I really thank again to Jochen that I could do this, because I built up my character with this, you know, to become open for the world and a good person, able to do things and to able to take experiences, you know.
Yeah.
Can I just rewind a couple of years? You mentioned the Spa 24 Hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the 1970s, I mean, given the speed differentials between the cars, the ability differentials between the drivers, and you're on the Spa, I mean, how difficult a race was that at that time?
It kind of difficult was, because you had very little safety only, you know. I mean, we did.
You get through the Master King, in the BMW, little Fiat or something. And, you know,
that's right, yeah. But I mean, there was a good sense of common understanding between the drivers. We also had some terrible accidents, which in motorsport happened, you know. But it built up your character, because you knew you have to live with each other, not against each other, you know. There was competition on one side, but on the other side, fairness was a very important thing in my life that my dad taught me when I became a race car driver, you know. And I think in my whole 43 years, I got once punished for a thing because I pushed somebody off because I was braking too late, you know. And I think this fairness is also a very big point in my career, and I'm proud to be able to say so, that I have never been a constant guy who pushed somebody off the track, you know.
Well, we'll move on to that. There's an interesting connection between that and your role today in Formula E, as well as a steward. But we'll jump forward to that shortly. At this time, was your ambition to just race any car, any place, or did you have a driving ambition to go to Formula One or single seaters? How was your mindset at that time?
No, the mindset was just to get on the racetrack.
Sure.
Whatever that had four wheels, you know, four wheels is important. Two wheels, I'm pretty lots of respect, you know. But I think that was a great attitude, because with the variety of different things I drove, good cars, bad cars, single seaters, closed cars, sports cars, touring cars, I improved my skills, you know, because every car had a different character. A touring car was a big, leaning, moving, doing like this. A sports car had to be very precise. Formula One car had lots of power, a lot of aero. And the versatility that I learned by this, you know, was for sure one of the good things I needed for to be able to do all this, you know.
Sure. And of course, your graduation to Formula One came after just 6 open wheel races. I mean, that is extraordinary. I mean, you mentioned the license situation earlier on. Did you have the license? How did it work?
There was no license necessary, you know. I was scheduled to do Formula 2 in 74.
Yeah.
And then in January, Max Mosse ring my dad and said, Hans, we have a problem. Our main driver, Jean Pejarier, moves to Shadow, I think. We have a seat free, and we don't have anybody to drive for us in Argentina. Could you maybe, your son, do it? So daddy asked me, I said, Formula One, oh, Jesus Christ, yes, I go to Argentina, you know. Arriving in Buenos Aires, never sat in my life before in a Formula One car. We did the seat down, and I went on the track, you know. Can you imagine? For a 24-year-old guy is pretty heavy thing. You know, I was driving around a couple of laps, and I felt pretty comfortable, and all of a sudden, a car passed me on the outside. It was Carlos Reutemann. I said, okay, now it's time to go home. I never can do this. So I took my heart, I went up to Mr. Reutemann, said, Carlos, my name is Hans Stuck. I'm a young Formula One driver. I've never been on the track here. Could you please be so kind and explain me the track? Come with me. took his private car, did 20 laps with me around the track, explained me everything. And it was like 15 in qualifying, which was cool for my first event, you know.
Yeah.
So thanks to Carlos, you know, he showed me a lot, you know, and that's how it all started. But the pressure was immense, you know, as you can imagine.
Did you have pressure? Was it pressure you put on yourself, or was it pressure from your father? Was it pressure from the team or yourself?
I mean, all of a sudden, as a young Bavarian chicken, being with all those guys, Nicky and Carlos Reutemann and Carlos Pace and Claudio Gassoni. I mean, oh Jesus Christ, you know, me, the unknown person from the mountains, you know, in the top class of motorsport. Can you imagine with this age? I mean, now, because everybody is so young, it's not a big problem, you know, but for me, it was a big problem, you know.
Yeah.
But I managed it, was okay, and after the first two or three races, I was pretty familiar with what was going on.
But you were still balancing other drives as well.
I had a contract, you know. Yeah. So I was telling yesterday, there were 3 weeks in a row, I did touring car, Formula 2, Formula 1, you know. And once, I remember there was a Formula 1 race in Brands Hatch on Saturday, because racing is here in England on Saturday, and Sunday was touring car race in Diepholz on the airport in Germany. So I flew over on Saturday evening, did Sunday race in German touring car, you know.
Yeah.
Good.
So how much time did you spend at home during this period?
Enough to change laundry, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure, I'm Simon, I can see you got a Capri question, haven't you? Or was that the spark?
No, not yet. No. Well, that was the spark question. Yeah. I was going to ask, how comfortable or how quickly did you feel comfortable in Formula One? Because it was so different and you got there so quickly.
You know, you see my height, 6.4, you know, was a bit of a problem. I was always sticking out of the car.
Above the air, into the airbox.
The airbox, which was bad for the air coming into the engine. And also from the wind resistance, you know. You could see that I was lacking maybe 200-300 revs at the end of the straight against my teammate, like Ronnie or so. But there was no choice, you know. It was became difficult when there came a rule that you have to put a piece of wood from the front roll bar to the rear overall hoop, you know, and the driver had to be below this. So I really had to wind myself into the car that fits, you know. So being in a Formula One car, sitting was not very comfortable, but I mean, what do you want to do? I had to. And then so after this third, fourth race, then I began to know everything. I learned the system, I knew how it works, how race strategy works. No, it was okay.
Must have been quite difficult when you were given the offer to think, if I perform badly, maybe that's it. So did you think maybe I'm not ready? Or was
I mean, this was always the pressure behind my neck, you know. I mean, if I'm not giving a good job or crashing all the time, I knew I would lose my seat, you know. So thanks to a good education and thanks to the good genes of my dad and my mom, you know, I was able to manage it, you know.
And was it a free drive with March? Because Max wasn't known for giving free drives.
Yes, I even made some money, a little bit, you know, a little bit of money. But was some money, got the expenses paid, and got, I think it was $5,000 per race or so, which was good for a 24-year-old, you know. And then, of course, when Jägermeister came in later, then was some big money for these days, of course, you know.
There's a question here from a Griff Jones, which refers to the 1974 Monaco Grand Prix and the March time. So there was the accident, of course. Griff mentions that in Mike Lawrence's book about March racing cars, there's a passage regarding your accident. He writes, Stuck's car launched into the air and into a spectacular crash. He escaped without physical injury. What it did to his edge is another matter. He was never quite the same afterwards. Do you agree with that assumption?
Absolutely wrong. I mean, the thing was because James closed the door, which happened in Formula One. I went over his with my left front over his right rear, so the car moved up in the air. And a picture, never forget this, because on the right side was a fence, and there were people leaning over the fence. You know, so it was just like the car didn't go into the fence area because it would have for sure injured many people. So the car went down again and then hit the guardrail, but physically the crash was not bad at all. And for sure, remembering did not harm me in any case. Definitely not. No.
So, I mean, this was possibly the most dangerous era in Formula One racing in the 70s.
You better believe it.
I mean, it was. Yeah. I mean, it was one after another. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you manage to continue racing to put this stuff aside?
This is a question I've been asked a couple of times. Yeah. You know, and it is a very lucky thing that is in my head, obviously. you know, when I lost friends like Ronnie or Gary Birrell or whatever, you know, or Tom Price in the States was really involved in the accident, I was shocked, really shocked. But when I got to the next race weekend and sit in the car, there was a switch that switched it off. And I did not think 1 second about it, you know. And this is, was very lucky for me, because if I would sit in the race car before the start or the practice of the race and think about what had happened a week ago to my friend, I wouldn't be able to drive. So there was an internal mechanism, which I can't explain, that it just wasn't there, lucky enough. Same with the Le Mans accidents, which where I lost my team partner and friend Joe Gardner, you know. I had to continue to win the race. When I stood in the car, it just wasn't there, thanks to God.
Yeah.
But I can't explain.
And another related question from Giovanni. There's a video clip of the 76 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. We can see you waving your arms, signalling to the other drivers only seconds after the crash. You were one of those brave drivers challenging the Nürburgring for real. But he asks, interestingly, how did that accident change Formula One?
It changed a lot in terms of the Nürburgring. Because after Niki's crash, then there was no Formula One race up there, you know, because the Nürburgring in these days was at the limit for Formula One, because with these corners you couldn't look around, almost no runoff areas. We had these stupid catch fences with big wooden poles which hit Niki on the head, for example. So already before the race, we had discussions in driver's briefing. I remember that James Hunt, one of the leading guys, he said, I don't want to race here because it's just too dangerous, you know, compared to other tracks. Yeah. And they were right, you know. So finally, with this accident, Niki, he put some new input into safety of Formula One, which was in these days totally all right.
And do you think it happened soon enough? I mean, we still had another, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years where there was some very serious accidents. But do you think there should have been changes to the vehicles in particular maybe at that point, or it just...
But, you know, this is a certain development of time. For example, if I jump back to the days of my dad in the auto union, you know, I get to drive this car 2 or 3 times a year, you know. I'm still wondering, how could the guys do this? There were no seat belts. There were a terrible seating position in the car. But in these days, for them, they didn't have any better. It developed from there. So in my days of Formula One, I didn't have any better. But it developed because of people were thinking about it, you know. Look at Formula One today now. Yes. I mean, who would ever thought we have this 20 years ago? Look in GT3 cars. Look in terms of track safety. It is always at a time, and then it improves. But this is normal. It's the same in a normal life as well.
Yeah, sure.
And your father drove an auto union with a cloth cap on.
Cloth cap, goggles, no seat belts, you know. The arms hanging out on the side, you know. When they came for refueling, he put a towel around his head, then put the fuel. I mean, okay, but they didn't know any other, you know. That's right. It's the same with when you. I'm a pretty good friend with Reinhold Messmer, the famous mountain expedition man, you know. When you go to his museum, when he climbed up to the whatever mountain, the equipment he had, you know, I mean, that he survived in these temperatures. Unbelievable. Now we have insulated clothes and shoes and everything. He didn't have, but he also did it, and he didn't have any better, so it's development.
Sure thing. There's a quote that I keep going back to when I look at your career, which is, a man is known by the company he keeps. Now, in relation to your career, the company you keep, I see as teammates. And I wrote down some of your teammates. So Peterson, Mass, Bell, Pirro, Bieler, Roll, Amon, Tom Christensen, Carlos Sainz as well is in there too. You've partnered with some of the very, very greatest drivers in history. What makes a good teammate from your perspective? And perhaps you can give me some stories of these guys and what it was like to drive with some of them.
Okay, so the first real star that I was able to race with was Ronnie Peterson.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from him. My mind was always open when I had one of these guys with me. Be open and look what they're doing. Check out what they're doing. So from Ronnie, for example, I learned he got into a race car. He did 15 laps, drove whatever was possible, and then started to complain. I did it other before. I did 3 laps and said, I don't like this, I don't like that, and then came in. But Ronnie gave me a good idea, but because after 3 laps you can tell what the car does, you know. So it was really good. And Ronnie, he was always giving 100%. which I didn't do before. I learned from him as well. Even the car was shit, sorry to say so, he gave 100%. That made him successful. So I learned from him, you know.
Yeah.
And all the other guys, like, what is important to have a good partner is that you don't have develop an ego. For example, a long distance race, you have a partner who wants to do the fastest lap in the night, for sure you don't finish a race, you know. You do have to do a job together. It's like being married, you know.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but that's what it is, you know. So Derek was fantastic in this, you know. Frank Pilla, we are competitive, good guys, you know. Carlos Sainz, he came into the Scirocco and he told us the chassis is undrivable. We liked it. So he put his ideas on setting the dampers, the car was 50% better, you know. So you never stop learning, it's incredible.
Wow.
I think also they learned some things from myself, you know, regarding telematic things of corner speed and braking points, but it was a vice versa experience, you know.
Yeah. And there's a question from Flying Kiwi, is his name here. A lot of us were sad to say goodbye to Chris Amon. What are your memories of sharing the BMW with Chris?
Yeah, Chris came to this BMW, came to the Nürburgring, not the Nürburgring, but he was shocked how difficult it was to go Nürburgring with a 3SL saloon car. It was a heavy leaning car and everything, you know. And he said, I think he was like, in the beginning, he was like 20 seconds slower. And he said, Hans, I can't do that, Chris. We sit together, we go around, I show you all the tricks, and don't worry, we're going to win the race, what we finally did, you know. But he was the kind of guy that you like in 2 seconds, you know.
Okay.
He was a fantastic. He was a star, but he was a guy totally fit on the ground, you know.
Yeah.
And by coming up and clicking together and see it works, we were successful, you know.
Yeah.
But you have to be open-minded, you know. There were some guys I did not get along with. I don't want to mention any names. But it happens. If you're too different, it doesn't work, you know.
Sure. Let's go back to a comment you just made about what your teammates possibly learned from you. How would you appraise your own driving? What were your strengths? And maybe go into a little bit more detail about what your teammates learned from you.
Okay, number one, they were all shocked about my rain driving ability, you know. Mm. I don't know, maybe my popometer here, the thing, the connection between the car and the road and yourself, but has special sensors, you know. But in the rain, I was always pretty good, and they were always said, how is he doing it? I said, because, you know, for me, when it comes to rain, I'm excited to master the rain. All the others, or most of them, they were scared of the rain. Aqua planning and how to put the power down. To me, it was fantastic to be forced to be gentle, to try them every lap, go a little bit faster, a little faster, because it changes in the wet, you know. I loved it.
Yeah.
And most of them were really shocked about my rain abilities, you know.
Yeah.
And they could also learn then. But rain, it was something I really still love, you know.
Yeah.
Was any of that down to your background, your upbringing, coming from the mountains, winter driving conditions? Did that sort of help?
Maybe winter a little bit, because in these days there was no salt on the roads and stuff like this, so you had to be.
You didn't have winter tires.
This is also because, like Mika Häkkinen, Mika Salo, now you have drivers like Valtteri Bottas. They are used to days of like 5-6 months winter in the year, so their reflexes and senses are maybe better than like in England, have almost no snow during the winter. Makes sense, yeah.
And we've talked about teammates. Can I ask you about team principals, or one team principal for whom you drove in the mid-1970s, Mr. Eccleston? What was he like as a boss, and what was your relationship with Bernie like?
Fantastic guy, you know. I mean, Bernie, he was pretty sharp, you know, but he was 100% reliable, what he said he did. You know, you could trust him, which is still the case, you know. He was sometimes he was a little bit strange, but I'm strange as well, I think, you know. But he knew exactly what I was talking about. I mean, what would Formula One be if he wouldn't have managed it the last decades, you know? He was a very good businessman. He was a smart team owner. He was a smart businessman. He knew what was going on. Really, I must say, to race for Bernie, apart from the days with Porsche, definitely the best man I was allowed to work for.
You say you can trust him, but the way he signed you...
I mean, you know, you know the story, you know, when I came to his office to sign my contract, he asked me how much money I wanted. I said, yeah, like the money I got the year before with Max Mosley with Mark was $100,000. I had to take care of my mom, everything. And then when we discussed, the phone rang, and it was obviously Arturo Merzario on the phone, the Italian Formula One driver, and they talked a little bit, burning up and said, Hans, this was Arturo. He's going to race for me for $30,000. You have 5 minutes time to think. You know, 30,000, not very much, but I mean, being in probably one of the best cars with the engine with Bernie, I do it. So I signed the contract. We went to Monte Carlo. First free practice Thursday was fastest. Bernie had me for dinner. I said, look, Hans, you know, we having obviously a long relationship going on for the future. I want to be honest to you. Remember sitting in my office talking about money and the phone ring? Said, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. The pocket is empty. Said, I must tell you, it was not Arturo. It was my secretary. She phoned me. You know? I said, okay, that's it. I mean, this is Bernie. It's his money. So why not, you know? But I got a good money for the championship points. I made a couple of points. So in the end, it was definitely worth giving in, you know. I like this kind of tricks. It's good, you know. I also fooled him because then we came to Hockenheim Grand Prix and we needed some tickets for friends, you know. He said, no, you get 2 tickets, nothing more. And obviously he opened his briefcase. There were tons of tickets in the briefcase. So he left the motorhome. I opened the briefcase, took 10 tickets out and gave them away. You know, he never realized, you know. I also told him afterwards, oh, you bad boy, you know. Yeah, but this is business in these days, you know.
There's possibly another Bernie story here as well, and it's related to a question from Giancarlo. So thank you, Mr. Stuck, for your racing. Very entertaining. And this is the question about flipping over the guardrail in Monaco during the pro car race. I believe Bernie wasn't particularly happy about that.
Well, that's right. You know, I had an oil pipe breaking, so I lost the car, went over the guardrail, jumped over the guard in between guardrail and fencing. Could hardly get out, and it took a while to get the car, and the guardrail was damaged. So that meant that the official qualifying had to be postponed, you know. And with the slot time for television worldwide, Bernie was very upset. You idiot, why did you do this, you know? Now we get problems with television. Yeah, Bernie, what can I do, you know? Now he was very much upset about it, you know.
Can I, just on the subject of pro cars, Brands Hatch 1980, about 15 pro cars arrived in a group. You were in the middle of them. You spun. Mm-hmm. And I've never... Usually a first corner spin, you lose, you know... I think you dropped from about third to seventh or something. You probably lost about 3/10. Can you remember that?
I remember, but about 3/10, I don't... It's not correct, no. But my good luck was that I managed to bring the car back into racing direction, shifted back in first gear and then accelerated again.
Because when you didn't emerge last, you were still middle of the pack somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, this is a time to when you when you feel you lose it, then the first thing is what I'm going to hit. But there was room, you know. And then when the car starts to spin, then you can influence it by braking or even put the throttle on to get it back into the right direction. And this was well managed, you know.
Was it also Brands Hatch that you and Ronnie Peterson went home?
Yes, there was another race with BMW, 320 Turbo. And after the start, after 2-3 laps, I crashed the car in the back of the track, you know. And I think it was over the guardrail, no, but it was sitting somewhere and I got out and I see everything, parts hanging off and everything. So I walked back to the pit, said, Ronnie, sorry. I crashed it, but we go home because it's over now because the race was going on. Okay, we leave, you know. He took Barbara, I took my wife, we left. I left to the airport, Ronnie was back on the way to Maidenhead. And next Monday, I got a phone call from Jochen Nierpasch's office. Mr. Nierpasch wants to see you right away in the office, you know. So I was living in Munich, I went to the office, and Nierpasch said, yeah, Hans, we have a problem. When you left the track yesterday with Ronnie, after a couple of laps, the race was interrupted because of an accident. They brought the car back, mechanics could fix it, and the car was on the grid, but there were no drivers.
Awkward.
And then he said, my dear friend, the only luck is that also Ronnie was gone. He would have gone alone, I would fire you now. But he couldn't fire Ronnie Peterson and myself, you know. So we had to pay 10,000 Deutschmark fine, both, you know. And then we learned a lesson, definitely, you know. Never leave the track before the race is over, you know. But if we do it nowadays, impossible. Sweating right now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Back to Bernie and the Brabbermouth Romeo time. Lucio Chiodi, I remember your first podium finish at Hockenheim and the Brabbermouth Romeo. You stopped right after the finishing line greeting everybody, happy like a Christmas tree.
Because I had to stop line. Because I ran out of gas.
Ah, there we go.
Going into the last corner, I feel there's no gas, and then there was a big headline in a German Bild newspaper. It was saying, Stuck, tuk, 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 tuk. Because I stuttered over the finish line, I had to stop. I couldn't make another lap, you know. Yeah. The tank was empty. The Alpha engine was great,
yeah,
but it was pretty high in consumption, so I just managed to go over the line and finish in third place, you know.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because at least you managed to get across the line, because usually with Watty, it happened about a lap and a half from the end.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah. But it would be a problem for now, because now I think you have to finish the last lap.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, so and you have to have a certain amount of fuel left in for it. Yeah,
nobody wanted to know about this.
And then, again, related to Bernie, there is a story, you can tell me whether it's true or not, about whether Bernie put pressure on you at your what could have been your last race. He said, you need to win this race, and you had pole position. So that's true. So Bernie said, if you win this race,
and you get contract. A contract for next year, because Parmalat wanted to have a Grand Prix winning driver.
Yes.
I hadn't won a Grand Prix so far. I was on pole. Next to me was James Hunt. Said, Bernie, you go out and win, and you get a contract for next year. You know, I said, super, let's do it, you know. So I had a pretty good start, but at the start, the clutch cable broke. Because in these days, the Alpha had a clutch cable. It was not hydraulic clutch, which was in these days sometimes happened. And I knew by leading the race that I have to do all the shifting with the 7-speed gearbox without a clutch, you know.
Right.
And also I had to change tires from wet to slick, so how should I get off in the pits with having no clutch, you know. So I was a little bit nervous, okay, and then made a driving mistake in a corner up the hill. I didn't get into gear, and I spun, I stopped, and that was it. You know, I knew that now my dream exploded, you know, because not finishing the race, not winning, no contract.
Yeah.
And Bernie said, sorry, I told you to get the win. Said, yeah, but it was your problem with the bloody clutch cable. Said, it's not my problem, you didn't win the race, so you don't get the contact. Then Nicky jumped in then, you know. So that's life.
Yeah.
One time you're lucky, one time you're bad luck.
Yeah. Well, maybe this was a trigger for kind of a second career in the 80s and sports cars. That was a fantastic period for you, wasn't it? That was, you know, was it... Again, was it an ambition as Formula One kind of closed its door that you would look to sports cars again, or was it always running parallel?
No, my main goal was to stay into racing, you know. Yeah. So I had my backup with BMW with touring cars, you know, which was nice, but it wasn't Formula One. And then when this Porsche 956 came and 962 came, you know, Walter Brun, my Swiss teammate in BMW, before I raced for him, he bought such a car, you know, and I got the chance to go into this Porsche and show my skills, you know. And then when Stefan Beloff left the Porsche factory as a driver, I rang Porsche and said, here, you know, Mr. Professor Bott, I have no contract for next year. I know Stefan Beloff is leaving, and he's a driver. I said, oh, you want to leave BMW? I said, I mean, for Porsche, yes, why not? Okay, come next day, and we signed a contract, you know, and I got a chance for my second career. I learned a lot with Porsche, complete different driving style to the cars, complete style of education, like Porsche was doing races, approaching races, and as you just said, it was a second step in my career, very successful step, you know, winning titles, races and everything that hadn't been the case so much before, so intensive.
Yeah, and this of course was also a period where you cemented your relationship with some teammates, and you mentioned Derek Bell earlier on, who's been a great guest on these podcasts before. Can you tell me a little bit about sharing a car with Derek and why you seem to have such great camaraderie and sympathy with each other?
I mean, Derek was helping me in 73 in Formula 2, you know. I was in a STP march on the way in Hockenheim and was actually on the way to the pits, and he passed me, he slowed down and made like this sort of follow me sign. Maybe he followed me before, I didn't know. So I followed him. 3 or 4 laps, he showed me where in Hockenheim could improve my time, which was very generous from him to do so. And that's when we became friends. After we always stayed together for a long time, and then I obviously read about his success with Porsche and everything. And then when I joined Porsche, the Professor Bott asked me, who you want to be teammate with? You want to be teammate with Jochen or with Jackie or with Derek? I said, Derek Bell, this is my man, because we also a bit similar in size, you know. We knew each other well, we had a good sense of humor, common understanding. And this was a good choice, because Derek, when we were together in the car, we never had any problems. We knew exactly what we could do, what we can do, what we should do. Mm. And when he was in the car, I was always calm and relaxed. And I hope he was the same with me, you know.
Yeah.
And this is it. And being good mates is important for team success.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Do you think Al Holbert was a little bit underrated?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Al Holbert, thanks you mentioned this, you know, when he joined us for Le Mans, I must say, I knew him, of course, and I raced against him in the States, but never knew before what a fine guy he is, what a precise guy in racing he is, you know. And he was a very 100% partner to our twosome with Derek, you know. And thanks to him, we won twice, you know.
And then 1988, I think you wrote for us that it was your greatest race, despite the one that you didn't win. So what are your sort of memories of?
This was with the night shift, I think. Was the one with the night shift?
Ludwig.
I was Ludwig. Ah, yeah, I was my friend Ludwig. Yes. Because, yeah, I mean, you know, this is the typical. I don't want to say any bad things about former teammates, but Klaus, he always wanted to be the best. He wanted to show that he is the best, which he sometimes was, definitely, you know. And he always was known for being extremely clever. And he wanted to show Derek and myself to do one more lap than the two of us, you know, to be the smartest guy in fuel consumption. But he fucked up, you know. He ran out of gas, you know. And he had to enter the pits with a starter motor. That's why we lost the race, you know. And I think, so cleverness is not everything, you know. You have to be down to earth, you know. I mean, okay, if we finished third place, why not? Nothing happened, but...
Your sense of humor at that point, did it desert you completely? You're famous for your...
when he was due to come in, I was next after him, you know. And we counted the laps, and then he passed the pits and said, hey, why don't you come in? I have enough fuel for another lap. We all said, that's it. It just doesn't work. Or he goes in third gear around the corner, right, in the track, which wasn't possible, of course. And then we see him coming, and all of a sudden he slowed down. And then, you know, okay, that's it. He outsmarted himself, you know.
During the 80s, while you were racing sports cars with Porsche, you also carried on doing some saloon car racing with BMW. I mean, was that much of a balancing act? I mean, were both parties quite happy with that?
Yes, absolutely. It was always true, because the Porsche team was together with Audi, and you know, the big man in the company was Professor Piëch, who actually then, when he was with Audi, he asked Porsche to give permission that I can drive for them, and there was no doubt that they would let me do it, you know. And also, as I said before, driving all kinds of different cars, even I did a truck race in the early 2000s, it just brings you forward. It's different experience, you know. You learn and learn and learn, and this is really good for your experience and your experience level.
Can I also ask, if you're talking of BMWs and touring cars, in 1983 you did a part season in the British Saloon Car Championship. It was quite political at the time, because you had Tom Walkinshaw with his Rovers and you had Frank Sittner with his BMW, and the kind of, there was a lot of friction between Sittner and Walkinshaw. And then you arrived, and instead of teaming up with Sittner against Walkinshaw, we then had Sittner against Stuck against Walkinshaw. And I was covering the championship that year, and it was great fun. But there was a lot of friction, but it was fun to watch. What are your recollections?
It was fun to watch, but I remembered, for me, it was a problem, because it was a right-hand drive car, you know. So the first car left, always touched the door with the right hand, looking for the gear lever, which was difficult. But you know, but the driving fun out of it was, for me, was fantastic, and I kept myself totally out of any politics, you know. So I did my job. Jochen Erbach was the boss. He told me what to do, and then I did, and that was it, you know. I mean, to drive it then against Tom was really interesting, because I drove against him at the Jaguar with the BMW, and driving with and against Mr. Sittner was interesting, but I kept myself out of political things, which was a good choice, you know.
I'm conscious that we'll...
It's called Trimoco Championship, wasn't it?
Sorry?
It was called Trimoco Championship, wasn't it?
Yes, the Trimoco or Tricentral.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Bring back good memories, you know.
I'm conscious that we'll run out of time if we won't get to our reader questions. So I'll go jump into our reader questions.
My pleasure.
Yeah, there's there's two here, and I'm going to go back to the sense of humour one. The first one is, who made you laugh the most in Formula One? And this is a question from Anthony Jenkins. And then I have a follow-up question.
Definitely James Hunt, you know, because he had some kind of attitude that is similar to mine, but 10 times more, you know. He was enjoying life when it was appropriate, you know. Yeah. He was full of shit, you know, and that's good. It was, so we had fun together. Yeah. One thing I didn't do, I didn't drink. Up to now, I do not drink. Maybe a little gin in the evening, but very little. But the rest, we were like, it was just fun to have him, you know, yeah, around, you know.
Was James underestimated as a driver because
no,
of his?
No. He did his job, you know. I mean, he was able to enjoy life and performing 100%. This is something that I really also was aiming for, because it's great. Because if you look at some drivers, they're so focused, there's no life around them, you know. Yeah. And for example, when we had this traveling around in Formula One, experience new countries, James and myself, we took a chance to stay a little bit longer, arrive earlier, and enjoy the life down there, because it's experience. Others come the minute before and leave the minute after. Terrible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Not getting any to know about the country, about people, because this is experience that also builds up your personal character.
Yeah. Practical jokes. I'm going to ask about practical jokes. And there's one story that I managed to uncover from the internet, which was about how you managed to make another driver crash using the assets of a certain
another
lady.
One story.
Perhaps that story can
be. Yeah, okay, we were in 75 doing IMSA race in the States with BMW with my teammate, Austrian fellow, very funny guy, Dieter Questa. And in these days, I had my girlfriend, Mookie. She was with me in these days, I told before. And Mookie was well known for the size of her breast, you know. And Dieter always wanted to see these breasts without anything covered, which, of course, is not possible, you know. She was my girlfriend, you know. So at this race in Riverside, we were standing. Dieter was driving practice, and Mookie, myself, watching in turn number 9, which was a second gear 90-degree turn. And we see Dieter coming, we wave, he waved back, you know, stuff like this. And the third time he came by, when he came, I from the back, I lifted Mookie's t-shirt, the breast fall out, Dieter look at it, and boff, question to the guardrail, you know, can you believe it, you know.
That's absolutely fantastic.
I mean, we were laughing our ass off, you know. So, but then, shortly afterwards, we had a report to Mr. Nierpasch, who was a great guy, but not known to be very funny. And he said, okay, guys, what you have done is unacceptable. It's very bad for a BMW reputation, especially in the States. I mean, to do this, you can't do it. And the punishment will be that you have to pay for the repair of the car, and we will not reimburse you for the expenses. Oh, that's a big problem. What did Questa say? Jochen, no problem. This was definitely worse. The people. cool story, huh? Yes.
Fantastic. I'm not quite sure how we follow that one, to be honest. Let me find another one here. Okay, let's continue on the American theme here. So this is a question from Jamie Smith. How did you enjoy racing in America, and in particular the Trans Am series in the Quattro Audis? You usually won when you raced the 200 Quattros in 88, and where does that car sort of rank in your personal pantheon? Tell me about
First
that.
Of all, my years in the States were, of all my experience in many years, were the greatest experience, you know. States is a fantastic place for a race car driver. The fans are really cool, you know. Lots of respect, you know. It's a good going together, you know. They really enjoy when you do something. Maybe also because I came there as a Bavarian guy, invented yodeling there on winning, you know. I was standing on the podium, winning, said, olete, olete, you know. They loved it to get this experience done, you know. Maybe this was the reason for this always open guy. And especially then Trans Am, because Trans Am, when we came there, the Americans were laughing at us, you know. A 5-cylinder engine, 2.1 liter against the big blocks, V8s and whatever, you know, said, are we going to blow those guys off? But they forgot that we had all-wheel drive quattro system, you know. And we really shocked them sometimes. And it was cool racing with Pete Horsma, all those guys, you know. And what always was good in the States, there was fair racing. You bump each other sometimes, but in the evening you go and have a beer together. That's totally different here in Europe, you know. Like I mentioned Klaus Ludwig, you know, we never met privately in the last 150 years, you know, for a beer. But in the States, you have your colleagues, you go skiing together, you do this together, you go play golf, you know. It's a different attitude. It's a top level of driving and competition, but there's also a sort of a camaraderie going on, which is great.
Sure. Okay. Let's move on to another question from Lucio Chiodi. What did your father tell you after that podium finish in your home Grand Prix?
He was very happy. He was actually on the podium then, maybe how he got the idea. And you could see he crying some tears, you know. He wasn't in the best condition of health. But of course, maybe I didn't, in this moment, I did not really realize what it meant for him. I realized when my son was the first time on the podium. And then I realized what it means that your own blood and meat is on the podium having won a race, you know. Then I realized what my dad must have felt when he was on the podium with me, you know.
Sure.
Great experience, you know. Especially when I was the first time on the podium with my son Johannes, winning a race at Nürburgring. We looked at each other, you see me crying also. And Johannes said, "Daddy, I know what you're thinking. You think about your dad. He's watching us from the top, or maybe he's in hell. We don't know yet." You know? Yeah, but those are really very. You see my emotions right now. You know, think about my dad. Thinking about being on the podium with my kid. You know, I mean, those are moments in your life you definitely never forget, and you are very, very privileged to be able to experience these moments. You know.
Sure. What are you like as a racing dad? Do you stand back and?
Yeah. Absolutely. Same like my dad. You know. I mean, when it really gets a little bit wild, I say, "Hey, my friend, watch it." You know. But this, which is mostly beside the track. No, when they're on the track, you can't do anything because you're not in the car, you're not aware of what's going on. So step back, be there, be a friend, be there when it needs to be necessary, but then...
So we have a related question from Robin Arnott from the Netherlands. Maybe he asks if you can tell us about experiencing driving the Auto Union that was driven by your father. And what it's like to drive that car. You mentioned it earlier on, but it's a hell of a car.
Coming back to emotions, you know. I just had it 2 weeks ago. There was an event in Austria, the famous Großglockner Hill Climb, which goes up the miles into the mountains. I was driving Dad's car again. And imagine, number one, going to this car, knowing my dad was sitting in there. Then I have his original goggles. I have his head. I have his gloves. I'm using the crest of our family ring. It's my ring. And then driving up there, imagine what those guys have experienced in these days, you know. I mean, lots of power, very bad road holding, bad brakes, you know. And there were, of course, on this hill climb, no guardrails. If you missed it, you fly down a couple of miles, you know, into the rocks. And then coming up on the top and you see the people, and I have some tears because emotions coming over me. Because being able to do this and experience what they have mastered in these days, you know, is a fantastic thing.
Yeah,
and I'm so happy that I can do this, you know. And the funny thing is, Johannes, my oldest son, he says, "Daddy, I want to drive this car from Grandpa. And when you have an event next time, just say you are sick and I jump in." And I hope the will let him do this, because then we have three generations in a race car, which must be really fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
To get also to show Johannes what kind of a brave man his grandfather was, you know.
Yeah. Because you mentioned no brakes, no grip particularly, but lots of power.
Lots of power, yeah. I mean, still up the Großglockner, and the problem was that you sit in the car in front of the turning of the center point. So when the car oversteers, you realize pretty late, you know. Mm-hmm. I had this when I did the Monaco Historic Grand Prix. Of course, I go very decent. And people say, "Hey, you're going sideways all the time. You don't feel it because you sit in front of the center point, and the back swings out a little bit, and you don't realize." You know, it's amazing what kind of driving skills they must have had. And you put, I mean, the engine is still nowadays fantastic engine. The response to the throttle is great.
Yeah.
The torque is great. Everything, and it revs perfectly, and it runs number one. You know,
cool, fabulous. Okay, so. A question from A.S. Gilbert. If Hans Hestock is in the mood, I'd like to hear the story about Nelson Piquet and the pen. This could be Nelson Piquet.
Fry pen or
does it? Ah, a pen as in.
Kugelschreiber. I need the guy's telephone number.
He has we will get back to you, Mr. Gilbert. We will find out.
Please connect us.
Do you mean a pen?
Be able to.
Or do you mean a pen as in where, you know, like after the race where there's pen?
No, those didn't exist then. I think it means one of those.
It means a pen. Okay, yeah. We'll find out that one for me. Okay. That's a mystery, isn't it?
Please connect me with the guy. Give me my phone number.
Yeah, no problem.
I will check it out for you. We talk about this.
Well, this one may be, this one I suspect will be slightly easier. This is from Matt in South Korea. Some stories about Vittorio Brambilla.
Yeah, so Brambilla Gorilla. You
tell,
know?
Yeah.
Yes, he was my teammate. He was really a sharp guy. But what take me most wonder was the amount of alcohol he was drinking before the race. Okay, he's Italian, so red wine is like tea for me, obviously. But every evening before the race, I think 2 liters of red wine were normal with Vittorio, you know. And he was fast, you know, he was focused. And I just can describe it. So the word Brambilla Gorilla meets exactly what Vittorio was. But he was a fine guy, you know, very fine guy, a straightforward guy, a great teammate, an exceptional driver.
Yeah, but he liked to drink.
I mean, okay, that's different. You know, like the tennis drink espresso or red wine, I prefer tea. Coffee, tea, or me. You know?
Okay, we're jumping around a little bit here. Now, this is from Nick B. I'd like to hear about Grand Prix Masters. How easy was it getting back into single-seater mode, and how near 10 tenths did you actually get with that car?
Yes, GP Masters was a fantastic invention, you know. And when I got called up and said, Hans, would you like to join a GP? I said, yes, this is like Christmas and New Year's and birthday on one day together. And getting back into a new day single-seater was a great experience for me, because from my times of single-seater, I was the last time in a single-seater was in, I think it was 91, when there was still BMW Turbo. Was it 91?
91.
And then I got the chance to drive this car the last time. And I was shocked how much power this car had. But the GP Masters car, with a normal aspirated engine and this fantastic chassis, I loved it, you know.
Yeah.
And I did the first test in Silverstone, and fine enough, I got right into it, you know. And fighting with the other guys and being able to be with a guy like Nigel Mansell or Jacques Lafitte and Eddie Cheever was not only an honor, it was a big pleasure. And you cannot imagine the fun we had, you know. And I mean, when we went to South Africa, people, or to Silverstone, people loved it. The fans were there because we had time to sign autographs. I mean, we were giving us hell together, but still the sense of competition was to have fun. And it was just great, you know.
Yeah.
It's really a pity that maybe it was not very well funded. I would also say we received too much money. I would have driven also for free, you know, but they pay us a lot of money. Maybe just a little bit over the moon, but I would love to have this back, definitely. Great. There were some good talks already with Bernie to have in GP Masters in some of the GP weekends, you know, which would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it didn't work. Still have some T-shirts at home.
What do you remember of that? Sorry, go for
that. I didn't attend any of the races. I mean, I remember the... I remember the first, there were only three races, weren't there, I think? Silverstone, Qatar.
Kalami, Silverstone and Qatar.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously the pro car, it was a similar format to the pro car.
Mm-hmm, right.
If you were to create a formula today for a kind of a legend series, would you use a fast single seater or would you use more of a sports car for that?
That's a difficult question, you know. I think it should be a single seater, you know, something like the GP Masters car was, you know, a good chassis, pedal shift gearbox. What is, I think, is important, same aero for everybody, you know, not any aero tricks, so you don't have dirty air. We could overtake everywhere. I mean, nowadays the aerodynamics created to produce dirty air behind the other car. Nobody can pass you unless you do this bloody DRS system activating, which is totally crazy, you know. But this was racing back to the basis, you know. Was really cool.
Let's now talk about today and Formula E. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about your role at the moment with Formula E and what you've got coming up?
Yes, in Formula E, I have the pleasure to be chairman of the stewards for a couple of races every year. So next season will be Marrakesh, Rome, Zurich and Germany. Without the four races, I will be able to perform as chairman of the stewards. I like the idea of Formula E because, I mean, it's an interesting alternative which fits into the future and nowadays with electro engines. I hope if we never replace Formula One, I'm very honest, but this is a different story. But the main important thing is it brings motorsport back to metropolitan cities. You know, it brings motorsport to the public. It's great. It's a one-day event, which I think is great, because we should really listen to the fans, what they want. Do they really want to sit 3 days on a plastic chair and watch Formula One, you know? Or can we maybe tour even in one day, you know? That's pretty good. Then I like it what people don't understand often is the being interactive with the spectators, the fan boost. That means drivers have to be nice, have to sign autographs and be nice to the public. Good help, you know. So, and the racing is good because I have, for example, they have as a driver steward Bruno Senna or Andy Suchek, they drove Formula E.
Yes.
And they were telling me the car is pretty difficult to drive. It has this immediate power. It doesn't have too much aero. It hasn't got the fantastic grip from the tires. So the driver is actually the key factor of winning a race or not, but I think it's very important, you know.
Yeah.
And for me, it's great. I'd be happy to be in there. Thanks to Mr. Todd.
you said earlier on that back home you've got a snowmobile and all the other toys, and you liked the smell, you like the scent of petrol, and you like the noise. So how do you feel about Formula E's? Well, I mean, you can hear the tires and you can hear the gear changes, but you don't mind that.
I can tell you a good story with this. I was at the first Formula E race in Miami, one of the first races with my wife. And I said, we went from the hotel to the track. I said, honey, is this racing? You don't hear anything. I don't like it. This is not racing. She said, honey, listen. 43 years, you put earplugs against noise in your ear. And now you complain because there's no noise. Think about it. And she is definitely right. And I tell you, it takes 2 or 3 races to understand the system, because in the end, it's when you hear the commentator, you hear different noises. You hear the shifting, you hear the tire squealing, the braking. You hear if somebody is crashing sometimes, you can hear it. And it's a good alternative. So why, I mean, I'm used to it now. I don't miss the sound because I still have the sound in other events, which is obviously good, you know. But for this event, I think it's great.
With your steward hat on, just going back to Max Verstappen at Austin, what would you have done? Would you have given him the penalty as a steward?
I mean, as an FIA member, I have to be careful now. But I think we have to find a good solution with these leaving track or not things, you know. I mean, there are some, in general, you can, if you do this or that or not. We had the same now with Sebastian Vettel in Mexico. He left the track. There was no penalty. I think it's time, for the sake of the sport, to find a good system for whether let them go where they want or have the same form of penalizing if this happens. You know, you can't do it either here, this, or either in that way. This has to be the most important step for the future, to find a solution. What can you do, or what will happen if you do it? That's important, because if you do it like we have done it now with Max, you know, I mean, he took his chance, so he cut it off. But the same was with Vettel in Mexico, and he did get no penalization, so that's not good for the sport.
But I'm sure that Hans Stuck, the racing driver, you would have attempted exactly the same maneuver that Max did, wouldn't you?
1,000%. The hole is open, you go in, you know.
1,000%. That neatly summarizes your your career. I have to thank you very much for a wonderful hour. Really, really fabulous. And also thanks to Simon Aaron, our features editor, and to Jack Phillips, our digital editor here. What a wonderful hour. I really hope you've enjoyed that talk show with the Royal Automobile Club. We'll be back soon, and we'd love to invite you back for another one soon as well.
Definitely. I hope you enjoyed it. The public, always nice to be here. It's an honor for me to be here. And please keep on racing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.